It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Curious Wisconsin. We'll take you to the Eagle River Ice Castle.
First, January is Human Trafficking Awareness Month, and the Wisconsin State Legislature is currently circulating a new bill addressing the issue here in Wisconsin. The bill had 20 co-sponsors by yesterday afternoon.
The bill was authored by Republican Representative Amy Loudenbeck and Senator Jerry Petruski, with backing from Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen.
The bill comes after a Department of Justice study last year that showed law enforcement agencies in Wisconsin routinely deal with human trafficking. Here with us to talk about the new bill is co-author Representative Amy Loudenbeck of Clinton. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Amy, why is this the right time to address, to introduce this bill?
Well, this will be the third human trafficking proposal that the legislature has contemplated since the mid-2000s. The first bill in 2007 was identifying it as an issue and creating some definitions and legal mechanisms. Last year, we provided some additional supports for law enforcement. And this bill, this package of bills, the time is right because it's building on what we've done in the past, but it's really getting down to some of the issues in particular that victim advocates have been concerned about, where I think we've identified the problem, we've created, we have good systems in place for dealing with it, and now we're adding even more resources and strength to the current law that we have.
Can you give us a sense of just how widespread the problem of human trafficking is in Wisconsin?
Well, I think we can look back to one of the incidents this summer where 10 children in Wisconsin were rescued from child trafficking networks, and there was a nationwide FBI investigation going on in Wisconsin, and that is something that I think surprised a lot of people. One of the reports that I referenced last session on the bill that I worked on was called Hidden in Plain Sight, because oftentimes if it's child trafficking, if it's sex trafficking, labor trafficking, it's going on around us, but we're not aware of the psychological patterns that are going on in another, you know, outside of what we see in public. And this is really bringing to light some of the really egregious and horrific things that are happening in Wisconsin, and recognizing it's not just a rural issue or an urban issue. It exists around us. We just haven't been looking for it.
What new strategies for dealing with human trafficking and its victims does the new bill suggest?
One of the strengthening aspects that have been added is to apply some of the racketeering and forfeiture provisions that exist in a drug dealer or someone is going to have some financial downside when they're facing a conviction. And so things like vehicle forfeiture and other financial hardships are going to be put on these traffickers. And so those financial penalties did not exist under current law because, again, with the definitions, we had to add sex trafficking and add that to the existing process. So some financial hardships for the traffickers, and then there's some significant improvements in the way that the legal system looks at victims of trafficking, particularly minors engaged in sex trafficking, that, you know, these young people are victims. They need access to services. They should not be treated like criminals. Really important differences in the way that we look at the victim versus and the pattern of abuse and recognize it for what it is.
And there's a specific provision for individuals who've been charged with prostitution too, right?
Yes, there is a provision in the bill that would allow someone to come forward later and provide evidence that showed that indeed that they should not have been convicted of prostitution, that they should have their conviction vacated or expunged, and to make their case and lay out the facts of why they didn't disclose at the time that they were a victim of human trafficking. And it could have been because their trafficker was a boyfriend or a family member and they were afraid, and so they just took the prostitution charge and then, you know, later maybe got their life together and realized, you know, I need vindication, or this is preventing me from getting employment, and I shouldn't have this on my record. I was a victim. I wasn't a criminal. And so this creates a process for them to go through the legal system and possibly get that off of their record.
Who do you expect to be most affected by these changes that are being made in the bill?
I think that over the long term, law enforcement and prosecutors that have come forward that where because this is an evolving kind of understanding in statute, that the prosecutors will probably have a lot more cases that they can actually bring through and prosecute. There's some other definitions and some other things that are inside of the bill that are going to make it easier for prosecutors to say, you know, I know what's going on. There's a pattern of abuse. This is trafficking, but I'm having a really hard time proving it. And this bill is going to make it so that they can put the bad guys away, because it really is something that is it's frustrating for them, because they see these victims, and unfortunately sometimes we can't help them.
Now, you referenced that the last human trafficking law passed here in Wisconsin in 2007. Do you think there's kind of been this sense that, yeah, human trafficking is a big problem, but it's a big problem somewhere else, you know, like on the coast, maybe in California, Nevada, the East Coast, but maybe something recently, you mentioned the case this summer, it's been hitting home that this is a problem right here in Wisconsin?
Well, unfortunately, the traffickers, they prey on vulnerable populations. So if you're looking at, you know, at homeless teens or at people that are at a financial disadvantage, they're taking that situation and using coercion and using sometimes physical force or other types of power to take over, you know, someone's personal body. And when you look at the vulnerable, where there are vulnerable populations, I think in any state, it's not like international, you know, sex trafficking rings. This is somebody taking, you know, finding and targeting vulnerable people and victims. And, you know, in Wisconsin, we're generally a trusting society. And so, you know, to think that someone is, you know, they're trying to help you when they're not, it's a whole syndrome of abuse, of psychological abuse. Again, something that there are vulnerable populations here and people are trusting. So it's definitely happening.
Do you have any idea about how Wisconsin stacks up in terms of volume of human trafficking as compared to other states?
That's not something I'm comfortable quantifying. Again, I think that we're going to see with these bills, we're going to see more prosecutions coming out. But as far as where it exists and the number of incidents, I don't have a whole lot of comparisons. There are groups that compare Wisconsin to other states as far as how we rank in our efforts to combat human trafficking, and we're moving up the ranks in that regard. But we're still kind of in the middle.
Have you personally met any of the victims? Is this at all personal for you?
No, it is not. Although there are going to be, it's my understanding that we are probably going to have some folks testifying this time around that are victims. Someone that, especially in the case of the prosecution, the vacation of the prosecution, that we're going to have someone that will share their story and what happened.
Now, as of yesterday, this bill was just introduced, and you had 20 co-sponsors already. Were you surprised at the amount of support early on?
I was very pleased. Strong bipartisan support, and I think part of it is, you know, having the Attorney General who is known for. I mean, we've spent a lot of time on the drafting and making sure that these ideas have been vetted and that they're good. And for me, this is the second time I've worked with him. So, you know, people in the Assembly and the Senate, you know, a lot of us voted for a proposal that was similarly authored last session. So there's that trust as far as in the issue area. But and people have also known that we were working on it, so there was some expectation that people were going to jump on. But I'm actually pleasantly surprised, and we've gotten a few more in today, and we still have about another 24 hours left. So hopefully we'll get some more.
Now, as you said, the last human trafficking bill passed in Wisconsin was in 2007. And so here we are 7 years later. Are there things in this bill that you still feel could use addressing, maybe for another bill down the road?
There's always remaining. Actually, there was 2007, there was 2011, and then there's this one. So this will be the third. But there will continue to be recommendations and policy suggestions that come from advocacy groups. I mean, we're trying to choose things that we know we can implement and we can make work within existing laws. Some states, Minnesota has what's kind of considered the gold standard. It's the Safe Harbor Act, where it really gets all of the different service agencies, corrections, children and families in our case, and other the CPS to work together with law enforcement to, again, provide the services to the victims. We don't have a comprehensive approach to this right now. And so, but it's something that would require a lot of agency cooperation that obviously would require some funding. So I see that as something that once we have the enforcement framework, that we can work more on the support services for victims.
So that might be down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of down the road, when can we expect this bill to go to the legislature for a vote?
I would hope that with something that we can be looking at in committee during the later part of January and hopefully looking at floor votes in February would be very exciting, I think, because we are running out of time in the session here.
Well, Representative Loudenbeck, thank you so much for joining us and for talking about this today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Representative Amy Loudenbeck. She co-authored a new human trafficking bill in the state legislature.
Next on Central Time is Curious Wisconsin. We'll explore the Eagle River Ice Castle. That's coming up here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Time now for Curious Wisconsin. This week we head to Eagle River to find out about a castle made of ice.
It's an annual tradition in the town dating back to the early 20th century. Built by local volunteer firefighters, it brings visitors from all over the state and beyond.
We've got Jim Bonson with us now. He's the deputy fire chief at the Eagle River Fire Department. He helped build this year's castle. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi, everybody.
Well, first of all, can you tell us a little bit about this year's ice castle?
Well, this year's ice castle is the first one we've been able to do for the last 3 years due to the problems with the ice thickness the last two. But this year, the ice was up around 15.5 inches, and so it worked out fine. We love doing it between the holidays. We're able to get more people to help us out. And it makes the project go a lot quicker.
Can you describe it for us? Tell us what it looks like and maybe how big it is.
Well, the ice castle is approximately, the middle tower is roughly around 25 feet high.
Ooh.
Wow.
We've got two thrones on it this year, one on the north side, one on the south side for picture opportunities. And it's roughly probably around 25 by 30 feet in diameter.
Do they keep getting bigger and bigger over time?
Well, we're limited to the space where we can build it, and probably it's good that it doesn't get bigger and bigger all the time. But, you know, the space that we have able to build it in Eagle River limits us in sometimes the designs that we can do, just because it's we got a snowmobile trail that is one side, parking on the other side. So we get sort of limited with this location. And this is the only location left, really, to build the ice castle where everybody can really get a view of it.
So how do you build it? Do you drop a plan and then you carve blocks of ice, or is it some newfangled way?
Well, actually, we go back to the days when they actually harvested ice, when ice harvesting was a big business in northern Wisconsin, and they were sending ice down to the Milwaukee and Chicago metro areas by rail. And the ice castle started in 1933 was the first year that Eagle River had one. The owner of the ice and coal was Chuck Hankey, who happened to be at that same time the fire chief here in Eagle River, but there was no association between the fire department and the ice castle then. So actually, we're using the same tools, the same saws that they use when they harvest ice. And the first day of the progress is to score the ice, and we score the ice 10 inches by 20 inches, and approximately we try to get as deep as we can, 10 to 12 inches without going through the ice, as we do not want the water to come up or we score it and refreeze it. The second day is the day that we take the ice out of Silver Lake. And this year we pulled 2,400 blocks out. It was about a 12-hour process to get all the ice out of the lake.
Wow.
And then on Saturday we have a shaver that we made so we can get all the ice so it's the same thickness, because that really speeds up the construction process. And then from that point, it's like just laying cement blocks, except we're using ice.
I don't know how much a 10 by 20 block of ice would weigh. I've never picked up that chunk of ice. How heavy are these?
Well, with my age, they get heavier every year. They go about 80, 85 pounds with the depth that we had this year, like I said, the ice was 15 and a half inches, and we shaved off an inch and a half, so we're dealing with 14-inch thick ice blocks, and they're roughly, you know, right around 80 pounds is what they're going to come out to. And we've got a system where we don't have to lift a lot of the ice, but there are some blocks that you still have to lift. And but we try to just slide ice the most that we can. We use the forklifts to help us get the ice up to the, each core so we can just slide it off the pallet onto the wall so we don't have to lift a lot of ice.
It's pretty amazing. You don't use a chainsaw or anything. You score the ice using these old saws. This is a labor of love that you do.
Well, it's a tradition. We still have the one-man ice saws. And we cut islands of 10 blocks at a time, float it down a channel to a conveyor, and then we break the ice apart as it goes up the conveyor. So that's the second day is where it's labor-intensive as far as the sawing part goes. And I try to get our younger bodies under there. I need exercise, but I don't need that kind of exercise anymore. So
at that stage, you've got the ice blocked and cut and ready to build. How long does it take to build the actual castle then?
It will run 2 to 3 days, actually, to get the whole structure up. And then we take a couple days to put some frills on it. We, you know, have special, we call them duhas, and we put on the corners to dress it up. And then we make these thrones where people can sit and take pictures. In Igloo River, the ice castle is probably the most photographed thing that we have when we're able to construct it.
It seems like for a long time, the volunteer fire department has been in charge of building the ice castle. Is it a fun event that everybody looks forward to, or do you go, oh, no, it's ice castle time again?
Well, the fire department's been doing it actually since 1987. And the fire chief then, his name was Jack Thomas, and he happens to be the grandson of Charles Hanke. So that's where we were able to inherit all the tools. And he has designed all the ice castles since 1987. And he actually uses, like, Lego blocks to lay out a design, then transfers that over the graph paper, and then figures out approximately how many ice blocks we're going to need. So.
And does he come and act as the foreman and make sure you're getting his design right?
Yeah. He does it all the time since we've been doing it. And he's 77 now, and he's still active with it. I've been active with the ice castle since 1978. And then it ceased for a while, and that's when the community approached the fire department and see if we'd pick the project back up again because it's something that the community really loves. Our visitors that come here, the tourists, snowmobilers, they just get fascinated by it, you know, just this structure of ice. And so it's been a tradition. Those of us that do a lot of work on it, we do like doing it. But, yeah, there are times when it's like, as you get older, at least the older I get is, oh, another year of doing the ice castle.
I bet the town loves it, though. How long does it usually stay up before it starts to melt?
It will stay up probably with the cold temperatures we've inherited this year. It should be up till almost the end of February.
Does it melt away, or does it eventually break the ice underneath it and kind of go real dramatically?
It's more of a melt than maybe a evaporation with the wind. Once it starts getting into where the cracks are, then the wind really starts to eat it away. And so we keep it up until it gets to a point where you feel that it's no longer safe to keep up, and then we'll take a backhoe in there and knock it down.
You don't want tourists coming in and wandering in just as it's getting ready to fall on them.
Right.
Makes sense.
You know, it all varies on weather. If we get into a real long, warm spell, that will cease the longevity of the ice castle.
Now, if somebody's listening and they're inspired by this whole ice castle building thing, do you accept volunteers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the fire department does, you know, we got quite a few of our members that are there daily. 20 to 24 of our members are there daily, but it takes more people than just that to do everything. And so we welcome volunteers. The local businesses and contractors, they come forward, you know, supplying either meals or hot coffee, hot chocolate, a lot of the equipment that we need as far as like the forklifts and that, propane gas and run the forklifts, that all gets donated. So it is really a community project and something the community is really proud of.
Jim, you've got two thrones there. Is there an ice castle king and or queen?
Nope, but we've had, in the past, we've had one marriage taking place.
All right.
And a couple of our governors have been up here with picture ops in front of the ice castle.
What would you say it's meant to the people of Eagle River over the years?
Well, since 1933, we keep doing it. And when it gets a few years where you don't have it due to the weather or whatever, people start talking about it again. And once it goes back up, it's just, you know, the compliments that we firefighters receive, it makes all the work well worth it.
Jim, thanks so much for joining us today. It's a lot of fun.
Sure. And make sure, if you've never seen an ice castle, come to Eagle River. And then we got the vintage races starting this weekend. Then the Snowmobile Derby is next weekend. There's a lot of activity happening up in northern Wisconsin.
Jim Bonson is the Deputy Fire Chief of the Eagle River Fire Department. We've got a picture of the ice castle now. We've got an old one, I think, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Give you an idea of what they look like. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk with an author about protecting and ensuring the safety of the world's clean water resources.
We'll talk with a guest who spent 34 years working for the CIA. In a new book, he charts the CIA's evolution from shadowy entity to an organization exposed to new laws and a lot of controversy.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a guest who says we should encourage a love of books by letting teens and tweens read what they want, from romances to horror and everything in between. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at the physical effects our emotions can have on our bodies, from pulse, posture, and much, much more.
First, our next guest is concerned that schools are missing something important when it comes to teaching literacy, the fact that reading can be fun.
And he says we should be encouraging that love of reading. One way to do that, let kids pick the books they want to read and let the kids read them.
Joining us now is Michael Smith, professor of education at Temple University and a former high school teacher. He's co-author of the new book, Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be here.
So you seem to say that in this culture of being concerned about literacy and making sure kids can compete on the global stage, that we're losing track of something when we introduce kids to reading. And that's fun. What makes you think that?
Well, it's not just in the introduction to reading. It's as they go through. It's when people talk about what reading does, what does for you in terms of career, in terms of college, and those kinds of things, and don't really focus on the pleasure that readers get from the act of reading, and that's what motivates lifelong reading. And so we decided that we wanted to look more carefully to see if we could understand more about the nature and variety of pleasures that kids take from the reading that they do.
Now, for your book, you studied the out-of-school reading habits of a group of eighth graders. What did they tell you about why they read what they did?
Well, we found that that they talked about reading, the pleasure they got from reading, in really four different ways. One was what we call play pleasure, and they talked about how it felt, how the reading was really almost physical act for them because they so deeply entered the story world that they were reading. They could see them, they could smell them, they could feel them. Perhaps our most moving finding, or one of the things that's certainly staying with me, having finished the book, is that they did, their reading allowed them to do sort of important psychological work. It's, they read to try to figure out the kind of person that they wanted to be and to try to figure out how to get to be that person. We call it inner work in the book. And that was an important thing that ran through all of the interviews that we did. Then they took pleasure, intellectual pleasure in figuring things out. And they took social pleasure. They used the reading. You know, reading is so often thought of as a solitary activity. But the kids that we talked to, they used their reading to affiliate with others, other readers. Friendship circles were built up around reading. So it's very interesting to see that sort of contrast between, I think, what is a conventional notion of reading being something that you do alone to the idea that reading is really a very social act.
So when I was in high school and junior high, the way that reading was taught was that everybody pretty much read the same book. There were different classes, and they may have had a different reading schedule, but everyone read the same book, and then we discussed it and tried to, as a class, sort of figure out what the meaning was. What do you think about that way of teaching reading based against your findings?
Well, I think that there is a power to shared experiences, and the kids in our study were were very interested in talking about how they like to talk with other people and get multiple perspectives on the reading that they did. So I think that there's a place for that, but I think that there's also a place for giving kids, even in school, giving kids lots of choice so that they can put their reading that they're choosing to do in relationship to the reading that they're doing in common.
Now, you talked about a couple of reasons that these kids wanted to read the stuff they did when they weren't in school. One of them was play and inhabiting these magical worlds, and another was trying to figure out what kind of person they wanted to be. What kind of books did they read that fell into those categories?
Well, one of the things that was interesting to us is that what the kids took out of their reading was similar, but the books that they read were very, very different. The kids in the study was a reader of dark fiction, books like Fight Club, and that's what she read. On the other hand, we had readers of romance. But both of them, both the reader of dark fiction and the reader of romances or vampire stories, found these same sorts of pleasures in the reading that they did. So it wasn't so much that they shared particular things that they read. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons we think choice is so important is that you can't really predict what it is that kids will gravitate to, but rather that what the fantasy readers got out of fantasy was in many ways similar to what the readers of horror got out of reading horror and what the readers of vampire novels got out of reading vampire novels.
So assigning a book to read for a class, it seems like, you know, the kids may or may not read it, and you could go online and just read the synopsis somewhere, get the crib notes. But what about the question about how schools are teaching it? Is that the wrong way to teach, or are schools maybe creating an aversion to reading when they teach to a single book like that?
Well, I think that there are, obviously it depends on the school, but one of the things that our kids told us is that schools, in their view, tended to sort of force books to mean particular things. They talked about how they sort of narrowed their horizons, if you will. And it was really ironic because we saw the kids doing with their out-of-school reading many of the kinds of things that are celebrated in school. You know, they were looking for themes, they were studying authors' techniques, and so on. But they felt sometimes that school forced them down particular channels and they resisted that. So I would say that, as I said before, I don't think that there's anything particularly wrong with having some reading done in common, but I think we should surround that teachers should think about surrounding that reading with reading that kids get to choose.
Is that how schools can inject the fun factor into it? What is the best way to do that?
Well, I think that we make a variety of suggestions for possible approaches. So let's take one. I talked about this idea of using books to really think about the kind of person that you wanted to become. One of the kids said something like, she said, what I do when I'm facing a problem is I think about my favorite characters, and I think about how they would handle this problem. And then I choose from what they would do, I choose the one that I think is right for me. Then she closed that turn in the interview by saying, characters are just ways of thinking, really. But if you think about So one of the things I think sometimes happens in schools is we don't use books to talk about those kinds of issues. So one of the suggestions that we make for fostering this kind of pleasure of inner work is to read texts that raise important questions like, what makes me me? Is it genetics? Is it personal interest? Is it race? Is it class? Those are big issues. Or to what extent are people responsible for what happens to them? Those are big questions that reading can help kids answer, and grappling with those questions. And they're questions that don't have any defined answers, so they don't sort of force readers into taking the same thing out of a text. So one of the suggestions we make is to build our instruction not around sort of technical issues, but rather around these bigger questions, these bigger essential questions that motivate people out of school reading.
Now, to go back to that student that you just mentioned who said she has a problem in her life, she'll go to a book and try to think about a way a particular character might handle it, and then she closed by saying characters are just ways of thinking about things. That's a pretty sophisticated way to think about a book. Do you think that, you know, maybe we're not giving kids enough credit when it comes to their sophistication level and why they may be reading what they're reading?
We were astonished at what... I mean, that girl was an eighth grader. I mean, we were astonished at the sophistication of the thinking that they were doing about their reading. And yeah, I think that's right. I think. Well, you know what? I've been teaching for a long time now. I've been teaching for 36 years, and I was taught lessons for sure about how kids were engaging reading. And I think back in the teaching that I did, I was so worried about what, you know, my kids were reading, I don't know, Sweet Valley High back then, romances, that kind of thing. What we found in our study is that rather than dismiss that, what we should try to find out what they're getting out of that. We found kids who were committed readers of vampire stories who are using vampire stories as a way to think about what kind of relationships they wanted in the world. So, yeah, I think that I certainly, as a teacher, did not give my kids enough credit for what they were doing with the reading that they were doing outside of class.
We're talking right now with Michael Smith, author of Reading Unbound, and he's making the case that we should let kids read what they'd like to read. What do you think about that idea? If you're a teacher, is this what you do? Do you let your kids direct the choices that they make and promote the idea that reading is fun and that one of the joys in life is the pleasure we get from reading? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with Michael Smith, who says we should let kids read what they'd like to read and encourage their love of reading as one of the fundamental pleasures of life and also a tool for literacy. And we want to hear from you. Do you think that kids should read what they like? Do you let your kids choose what they like to read? And what's their reaction? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And if you're a teacher, we'd like to hear from you too. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Michael, one thing I'm curious about is whether you think that as a society, as parents, as teachers, are we too worried about kids being exposed to what you might call literature in quotes versus, you know, just reading a book they like? Do we want to make sure that they are reading literature?
I think that if we take pleasure seriously, we're best served by, schools are best served by two things. One, having kids, creating context in which kids can read text that they're likely to take pleasure from, and two, to increase the range of texts that kids might take pleasure in, so, you know, like expanding their palate. So I think we should do both. I think, however, that the latter goal really dominates in school. I can tell just a quick personal story. When my younger daughter was in 12th grade, I went to her back-to-school night, and her 12th grade English teacher rattled off the books that they were going to read and then said something like this: but since we know they're going to hate all of the reading that they have to do, we show a lot of movies in here. That's probably the wrong message to give a kid in an English class.
Yeah, that's interesting. So if some teachers know that the kids are going to hate the literature, what's stopping them from changing it?
Well, you know, there are a number of pressures now that I understand. One is the Common Core state standards are put a strong emphasis on text complexity. They argue that kids aren't prepared. One of the reasons kids are not prepared for college is that they're not reading hard enough things in high school. One of the arguments we make in the book is that we need to think not only about textual complexity, but also interpretive complexity. Our kids were doing amazingly complicated work with text that people might regard as not being likely to provoke that kind of serious intellectual work. So that's one pressure. I think that there's another pressure about cultural, the idea that if they don't read it then, when are they going to read it? If they don't read Shakespeare in high school, when are they going to read it?
But what about that? Is there anything to that? Because maybe that is the only time someone might be exposed to Shakespeare.
Well, if that's the case, then we ought to read Shakespeare in such a way that kids may be more apt to read it or at least go to a play sometime in the future. Spending a month going line by line through a play that could be performed in a couple of hours, it might not be the best way to do that.
So maybe new approaches to teaching the material.
And putting it in, creating sort of textual conversations between the classic texts and other kinds of texts. So, one of the questions I think Romeo and Juliet raises, for example, is what sustains and interferes with love relationships. Well, so a lot of romance novels, vampire novels, are about that too. So we can engage kids in thinking deeply about the central questions raised by classic texts, and that I think enlivens the discussion that they might have about those texts.
I want to go to the phones now. Let's go to Patty, who's with us from Green Bay. Hey, Patty.
Hi, I love this conversation. I'm lucky that I have two boys that like to read, but our oldest, he didn't like to read initially, like in his early years, and we read a lot out loud to him. And he wanted to go to see Prisoner of Azkaban, one of the Harry Potter's movies.
Uh-huh.
And we told him he had to read it before he could go see it, and that was kind of a struggle. It was a situation where we decided to get him the compact disc, the book on tape, the audio book. And he just fell in love with the audiobooks. And Jim Dale is the narrator for all those Harry Potter books.
Yeah, yeah.
And it opened up a whole new world of adventure for him. It opened up a love of reading. He started wanting to read them himself. I mean, now he's a big John Gresham guy, and he's a senior in high school now. And he does really well reading. He doesn't have any problems. He's in all the AP classes for language and comp. But, we found that we had to just approach it differently. With our youngest, he absorbs all the books that are around him. He read the whole Redwall series, and the neighbor kids, they built forts for Redwall in our backyard last year, and we did a Redwall this fall. And they actually have a Redwall cookbook, and we used the recipes out of the Redwall cookbook.
Wow. So maybe he saw his big brother reading too, huh?
Yeah, he did. And it became a big neighborhood event, this Redwall feast, so...
Oh, that's so cool, Patty. Thank you for telling your story and sharing that. And let's look at Patty's oldest, who was reluctant to start reading. They had to kind of prod him, it sounds like. But it makes you wonder how many kids are out there who just never got hooked on that right book initially that showed them what reading could be.
And that's a great question. One of the things we found with the committed readers, they like what you said about that series books. That's why people shouldn't worry about series books, because there's such pleasure involved in getting into a series. And even though one of the things that we found with the readers of Harry Potter that was so interesting is that when they finished reading a book and they took pleasure in reading the book, there was also a tremendous amount of pleasure waiting for the next book, thinking what was going to happen. So series books provide a kind of pleasure that other kinds of books don't, because there's that pleasure of anticipation and figuring out what directions the writer might be taking the series. That also contributes to why people enjoy them so much.
Well, Patty, thank you so much for that call. And we go next to Ken, joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
I was telling your screener, I have a 17-year-old son who we started him on, again, the Harry Potter series, and with the first book. This year for Christmas, he asked for a gift card to Barnes & Noble, and assuming that he was going to buy his music or whatever, he spent $100 on books.
Wow.
And the thing that gets me now is we do not censor what he reads. We let him read whatever he wants, and if he's got questions, he asks them, and if he's got, you know, plot line or subject line issues, he'll ask them. And he has gotten into an author named Christopher Rice, who writes detective novels, and his detective is gay. And my son thinks that's the most interesting thing in the world. Although he doesn't seem to have those proclivities, he really likes that genre. And, you know, I'm glad that he's a reader. But the Harry Potter series, Stephen King, he really likes, and Christopher Rice. And I enjoy the subject, and, you know, I'm really glad that I've got a reader in the family.
Okay, Ken, thank you so much for that call, too. So $100 on books for Christmas, that says something about the love of reading there. And Ken isn't censoring at all. Is that something parents should think about practicing at a certain age? I don't know if middle schoolers still need some guidance about reading things about subjects that might be too difficult for them to handle yet. But do you think in general that's a good rule of thumb, don't censor?
Well, one of the things that I learned from our study is to try to find out what they're getting from the books that they're reading. So, for example, when I was worried when I was a teacher that the girls in my class were reading these romances that were teaching them. I taught in a working class high school that were teaching them to be sort of submissive. What I found from doing this study is that the girls who were reading romances did not take on a submissive role, but were rather, or embrace that, but were rather using those books to think about, as a way to exert sort of power and to think about the power in a relationship and the kind of relationships that they wanted. So I know in my own case that I have made mistakes in presuming why people were reading something instead of finding out and talking with them about why they were reading something.
Let's go next to Anita in Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hi. Coming from an old Irish family, it was instilled in me very early, the value of reading, where Irish Catholics were not allowed to be educated, not allowed to read. And actually, my grandfather taught himself to read by hiding books up in the hillsides under rocks. And so it was like that. And I think in today's world, we look around, we know much more about what's happening, especially with women and education and reading. And I think when some of the assigned materials are being assigned in classes, you know, somewhere along the way there, whether it's in their sociology classes, geography, or indeed in the liberal arts classes, that it needs to be brought home how lucky we are, and especially it being almost obligatory on American women and Western women of all kinds to know that reading is a right, but not for all, and that it needs to be really valued as such, the fact that we are allowed to do that, and then introduce the horrible assigned reading that the young kids don't want to read. And I think it's not so much entertaining them now that's important. They might hate it. I did not like reading All Quiet on the Western Front when I was younger. But believe me, you know, I'm in my 60s now. When Vietnam came around, oh, wow, could have had a V8.
All right, Anita, thank you so much for that call and for sharing your points there. And as we wind up here, Mike, I want to ask you, what is the takeaway here for parents as they figure out what their kids should be reading?
I would say that to treat the reading choices that they're making with respect, not to worry so much about whether this is a book that they're going to read in college or whether it's going to help them in school, but to recognize that readers read books that they need, you know, that support them in doing something important to them. That's the big takeaway that I took from our study.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate the time.
That was Michael Smith, co-author of the book Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them.
Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at how our emotions physically affect our bodies. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.